Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
This morning, I wanted to buy some decomposable coffee pods from a website. It was a frustrating experience because it seemed the only way to buy the pods was to sign up for a monthly subscription, which would have cost too much and left me over-caffeinated. Eventually, by actually leaving the site and doing a second search, I was able to find a hidden part of the website that would allow me to make a single purchase.
The company's decision to organize its website in such a frustrating way is an exercise in what is called choice architecture. Choice architecture is the act of organizing the context in which people make decisions. And choice architecture is everywhere, from school cafeteria arrays to retirement options offered by employers to healthcare plans. So what principles can and should choice architects utilize in arraying choices? How do people analyze and make choices? And what gets in the way of good decision-making, something that our guest today describes as sludge?
This morning, we are joined by Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler, the co-author of Nudge. Nudge is a deep and surprisingly humorous dive into how we make choices and how and why we can and should be nudged in different directions. We are so pleased that he has made the choice to join us this morning. Good morning, Professor Thaler.
Good morning. And I will point out that it was the default option for me to join.
Early in the book, you used the example that I just referenced of a school cafeteria to sort of explain the overall concept of choice architecture. Can you lay that out for our audience as background for our discussion?
Sure. So the idea is we have this imaginary person who, let's say, is in charge of all the school cafeterias for the city of Chicago, and would like the kids to eat healthier foods, and thinks about, well, how could you do that? And decides to run some experiments. They don't change the food they serve. They just rearrange how it's organized. And what she discovers is, if you put the apples where kids can see them and take them, they eat more apples and fewer Twinkies. And this is a made-up example, but it appeared in the first edition of the book, but then people tried it, and not surprisingly, it works. So it's an example both of choice architecture and nudging. So putting the healthy food up front is a nudge, and it's a nudge for good. The experience you had buying coffee pods was sludge, which is nudge for evil. When you go to a supermarket and all the stuff in the checkout line that's in easy reach of toddlers sitting in the cart is not the stuff that mom or dad wants the toddler to eat.
So you talked about, I guess, bad structure of these types of things, but perhaps go into what is paternalistic libertarianism and how should it drive choice architecture?
So libertarian paternalism is our preferred order. And so it is an odd phrase. And the fact that it annoys people, it was part of the appeal. The idea is that, say, rearranging the order of the food is paternalistic in that we're trying to help the kids choose a healthier lunch, but it's libertarian in that we're not forcing anybody to do anything. Cass and I both love GPS because we're hopeless when it comes to getting around. We're always lost. Both of us rely on our wives to tell us where to go. But GPS, you know, when our wife isn't handy, GPS is a good substitute. And in our ideal world, there would be GPS for everything. And GPS lets you set where you want to go, but you can change your mind. And that's the way life ought to be. And, you know, when you're searching for coffee pods, it would be nice if the choice architecture led you to the most desirable option rather than the one that's most profitable for the seller.
And I apologize for bollocksing up libertarian paternalism. But it was interesting to me that, as you said before, those terms are seemingly contradictory. One doesn't associate paternalism with libertarians. So what I think you were trying to get at, and what I gathered from it, was that the concept of the libertarian comes from the fact that you're not limiting the choice. Have I got that right?
Exactly. We use libertarian as an adjective. It's a kind of paternalism. The phrase was invented on the fly when I was giving a talk here at the University of Chicago about a program that a student of mine and I invented called Save More Tomorrow. And the idea was you go to people in a 401k plan and say, would you like to sign up for a plan where you increase your saving contributions every year when you get a raise? It's voluntary. It's opt-in. Now, at this conference, there was an assigned discussant, which is normally assigned somebody to trash the paper in public in front of you. So my discussant said, well, yeah, this seems to work, but wait, isn't this paternalism, which is a curse word at the University of Chicago? And I said, well, you know, normally we think of paternalism as coercive. And you have to buckle your seatbelt. This seems to be a different kind of paternalism. I don't know, maybe we could call it libertarian paternalism, which of course he hated. But the next day at lunch with my buddy Cass Sunstein, I said, hey, you know, Cass, I came up with an interesting phrase yesterday at this conference that seemed to annoy my discussant to no end. Maybe we should write a book about this. And, you know, there we go. The rest is history.
Well, and I think there's multiple ways to look at why it's important to offer and have offerings in this way, because, you know, traditional economics assume that people are rational actors, which I think we understand that we're not, you know, and we do seek optimum outcomes. But, you know, you talk about offering a different take and discussing, you know, concepts of human versus econs. So can you explain that?
Sure. So anybody who's ever taken an economics course knows that the creatures you study in an economics textbook are not people you've ever met. They can look at all the healthcare options offered by your employer and immediately figure out the best one. And the same with choosing a mortgage. And they never overeat. They eat just the right amount. So we call these fictional creatures econs. Econs never have a hangover because they don't drink too much. They save just the right amount for retirement. So, you know, back when I was in graduate school, I kept saying, really? You know, those aren't the people I know. So I've spent my career saying, you know, really? And so we say, no, there are not econs. There are humans. And we know humans can't make these kinds of calculations and sometimes have self-control problems, but are also nicer than economists give people credit for. They contribute to NPR, to charities, and clean up after campgrounds and clean up their dog mess, which economists think nobody would do. So Nudge is a book that says, what can we do to help humans? And, you know, economists, the Latin phrase for econs is homo economicus. And we say we study Homer economicus because we study Homer Simpson. And we're trying to create a world that is safe for Homer Simpson. And Homer would need a lot of help.
So you talk about some of the things that differentiate our Homer person from our econ. Share with us some of the things that humans do that distorts their decision-making and would be helped by nudges.
Well, you know, one is status quo bias. So we stick with what is done. And how many times have you been told when you say, why do we have to do it this way? And the answer is, that's the way we do it. Or that's the way we've always done it. Now, you know, there's the song and Fiddler on the Roof, tradition. Now, traditions are fine, but sometimes traditions are stupid. And we're just doing something because that's the way we've always done it. And status quo bias also leaves us continuing to do things even when we should change. So once you become aware of status quo bias, then you can say, oh, wait a minute, I'm falling into a trap here. And being aware of what those traps are helps protect you against some of the most common mistakes.
So knowing what the traps are, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the segment, Rogers going out and finding the coffee in the pods, but that it wasn't set up in the correct way. You know, it was set up to maximize profit, not necessarily to maximize the best decision-making process. Is that what sludge is, or is it also something else?
Well, it's partly that, but as we talked about, the government emits a lot of sludge as well. So companies may be trying to maximize profits. Governments, the phrase that law professors like Cass like to use is administrative burdens, which is sludge in and of itself, just that phrase. But the fact that you have to fill out a lot of forms to get some government benefit, that's an example of sludge. There is a new child credit that the poorest people will have the most trouble getting because they have to fill out some forms, and it's automatic if you've been paying taxes and have a bank account. Now, think of the typical homeless person or person living on the edge. If you don't make enough money, you don't have to pay tax, and you may not have a bank account. So the people who need the money most have the most trouble getting it. Does that make sense?
It does. And this has far and away been the most interesting and humorous conversation I can ever recall having with a professor of economics. And I was an economics major, so we really appreciate you taking the time with us. I know we're going to run out of time soon, but I wanted to touch on something you discussed in the last chapter, which is you're talking about climate change and the traditional economics challenge of dealing with public goods. Can you share with us a little bit about your observations as to how choice architecture could help with the climate change problem?
Sure. So, you know, the economists define a public good as something that everybody can share and will tend not to contribute to. So, you know, here in Chicago, there's a fireworks display twice a week at Navy Pier. I happen to live in a place in Lincoln Park where I see it from one of my windows. I don't have to pay for that. And it would be hard, you know, the mayor needs money, but she can't collect from me because there's no way to turn it off for me. So the economic theory says people won't contribute to public goods. But people are nicer than economists give them credit for. And so they will. And what experiments have shown is you can increase the extent to which people will do the right thing and contribute to the public good if people can punish people who don't. So how can we use that in dealing with climate change? Well, one of the many problems with climate change is we have to get all the countries to agree. And so the U.S. says, look, we don't want to, say, put in a carbon tax, which is what every economist, every 100% of economists say we need to have a carbon tax. But the U.S. says, well, look, we don't want to do that unless China and India do it. And they're emitting the most emissions. And China and India say, look, that's recent. The U.S. got rich by making all these emissions. So the U.S. should be cleaning up their act. Well, this isn't getting us anywhere. So what we need to do is something like the Paris Accord. We have to all agree to do our share. And the idea we endorse, which was proposed by Bill Nordhaus, an economist at Yale, is he calls them climate clubs. We're not sure that's the best name for it. But the idea would be all the countries would agree to do this and would agree to punish countries that don't take up their part of the deal, maybe through tariffs or something like that. So the other thing I'd like to say about climate change is, and one of the things we stress in the final edition of this book is that there are many things, well, let me say it this way. Nudge can help almost any problem, including climate change. Nudge is not the solution to climate change. It's way too big. We're going to have to do some big things, and we have to get the prices right. That's step one. But nudges can help, and they can help with this. And there are lots of, you know, we get text messages now. If the heat is high and we're threatening the power grid, that's a nudge. That can help. And nudges may help 1-2%, but, and that's good. You know, President Obama used to like to say, good, better is good, you know? So every little bit helps, but that problem is so big, we're going to have to go beyond nudging. And that's what we say in the new book.
We've been talking with Professor Richard Thaler, who is a co-author with Professor Cass Sunstein of Nudge, the final edition.
We have Ginger Wicks here. She is joining us from the Park City Restaurant Association, and she's going to chat with us about the 10th annual Dine About Park City. Ginger, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We are excited to have the Dine About again. As I just said, it's the 10th annual. Tell me a bit about this event.
Well, we created this event to help support our local restaurants during what has in the past been a slower time of year. It's a great time for the guests that are still here enjoying our community to get out and enjoy some great menus and price points. But it's also a way for locals to get out and enjoy some of their old favorites or even try some new restaurants that maybe they haven't visited in a while.
So Ginger, tell the audience, how does it work?
So the way that it works is this year we're offering a variety of different price points for two-course lunches, as well as a variety of different price points for three-course dinners. And so depending on the type of restaurant and menu that they're offering, the restaurants can determine which option fits them best. They sign up, and then they create unique menus for all the various price points that they may have chosen to offer. They can participate in all the price points, or one or two. And then it's offered between October 1st and the 9th. You can go in and at any participating restaurant, ask for the Dine About menu and enjoy the offer.
How many businesses, restaurants are participating this year?
We have 26 restaurants participating this year, which is a great representation of our culinary dining scene here in Park City.
I was surprised, as you had said, you know, it's an opportunity for people to try something new. And there were restaurants on here I had not heard about. Kita, K-I-T-A? Where's that?
That's in Pendry. That's one of their finer dining restaurants at the Pendry. They also have Opry Pendry, which is participating as well. So they're a new member to the association, just joining this summer, obviously, with the opening of that hotel. It's a beautiful facility. So, yeah, that's a new one that locals or visiting guests could go out and enjoy. I mean, it's such a beautiful time to be in Park City. The colors are, as you all know, going off. So this is a great compliment for folks coming up the canyon. They can see the beautiful fall colors and then enjoy a nice meal.
And are there other new restaurants that are on the Dine About list that you can draw our audience's attention to?
Well, Pendry is the newest, and then we have the traditional locals' favorite. Shabu, of course, is on there. Chamayo, Windy Ridge Cafe, Deer Valley Grocery Cafe, River Horse, Salt Box. But the Pendry is probably our newest member to the association.
And maybe just for our listeners, talk about what the association does and why, you know, like Pendry saw it as a good opportunity to join.
So we support the restaurants in a variety of ways. We meet on a monthly basis, and we help, you know, in the most recent years, try to help the restaurants navigate through COVID and understanding, you know, all the guidelines and different things that came out of COVID. We try to keep our pulse on liquor legislation and keep our members updated on any topics that may be coming up in the new legislative session that may affect them. So we're a resource in that regard. We try to support them in finding employees and different things like that. But then for many, we're an extension, or we are their marketing arm, if you will. We're supported by Summit County restaurant tax dollars. So everything we do from a marketing standpoint drives visitors and diners to our website, which is parkcityrestaurants.com. And there you can find, of course, all the participants in the Dine About. You can see which price points participants are taking part in. But you can also see anything also happening within the Park City community. The recent release of the new whiskey, Midsummer Night's Dram from High West. It's a great resource for dining in Park City. And so we support our members in that way, and helping push out whatever they may have going on through our marketing efforts and social media efforts.
Ginger, we really appreciate you joining us here on KPCW's Mountain Money. I know it was a last-minute request, but we appreciate you being able to fill in. We've been chatting with you about the 10th annual Dine About in Park City. Ginger, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. In his book, Adrift, America in 100 Charts, Scott Galloway provides a collection of his views on the essential question of America's sputtering progress. What the data has told him is not complicated. America is a work in progress, but it's made the most progress towards its ideals, and it becomes most like itself when it is invested in a strong middle class. Here to share his grand economic theory with us through data and charts is Scott Galloway. Scott, thank you for joining us this morning on Mountain Money.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin. Do you think America is adrift, and why did you write about it, if so?
Yeah, I think so it didn't call the book Lost. We can see land. We know how to have a progressive tax structure. We know how to have a strong middle class that we invest in. We know how to create connective tissue between Americans. I just feel like we've been taken a bit off course, but we can see land. We just have to decide to get back to it. I don't think there's anything wrong with America that can't be fixed with what's right with America. I think we're adrift.
And how long did it take you to write the book?
Well, greatness is in the agency of others. I have a wonderful team, and some of it was already done because it's a collection of charts, the majority of which we put together in our newsletter, No Mercy, No Mouse, which we put out every Friday. So it was essentially just sitting down with about 300 or 400 infographics and charts, picking the 100 that we thought were the most compelling. And then the hard part is chunking it all and creating a narrative around, all right, rise of the shareholder class, decline of the middle class, teen depression, polarization in our media, and then telling a story through charts. And there's narrative in it in charts, but it, typically a book takes me about 6 months, and then it takes the publisher another 6 to 12 months. I've committed to writing a book every 15 or 18 months.
And by the way, we should make it clear, one of the really enjoyable things about this book is that when you pick it up and start flipping through it, there are many, many, many charts and graphs that present data in a way that is pretty compelling and allows you to sort of visualize some things you may have heard about in other contexts in a more sort of intense way. Let's talk about some of those things. First one I want to touch on is something we've touched on before at Mountain Money, but one that just seems to come back repeatedly, and that is the notion of the rise of the shareholder class. Talk to us about what that means.
Well, throughout American history, every time we became more productive through manufacturing, technology, or management philosophy, wages kept track. Or if you look at the curve, or if you look at the line on productivity in the United States and wages, they look like two snakes dancing. They're sort of inextricably wound around another. America became more productive, wages went up. And then something happened in the early 70s where wages, they disarticulated from one another, and wages went flat for a good 50 years while productivity is still up and to the right. So we've had tremendous prosperity in America. We just haven't had the progress we'd like to see. And that trillions of dollars represented by surplus benefit between wages and productivity has been captured by one group, and simply put, it's shareholders. And that is, we decided to optimize everything for shareholders. And I don't know if it was shareholder activism or Milton Friedman or just this siren call of every CEO should just be totally focused on one stakeholder, and that's shareholders. But effectively, we have optimized everything for the price of shares. And the incentives around the people who make the decisions is around shares, because that's how they get compensated. And the result is the NASDAQ has quadrupled in the last 13 years. The minimum wage has skyrocketed from $7.25 to $7.25. So there's this illusion of complexity that the middle class suffering is a function of a bunch of features that are beyond our control. No, it's not. We purposely have decided not to raise minimum wage. If minimum wage had just kept pace with productivity since the 70s, it'd be about $23 a share right now. So these are conscious decisions we made.
And one of the things that you state kind of before you get into these chapters is it all starts right around the time of the end of World War II. Can you take us through that and say why you feel like that's kind of where the foundation of this problem began?
Well, a lot of wonderful things happened post-World War II. We had a boom in the middle class, and that is we educated and upskilled a lot of people. We had manufacturing technology that had been tried and optimized during World War II that was returned to the private sector. We had relative peace and prosperity. We had fantastic alliances with two other productive economies, Germany and Japan, and we became allies. And you would argue that kind of 45 to now, if you could only have one headline for the last 100 years, it would be something along the lines of America and its allies turn back fascism. If you could only have one headline for the last 70 years, it would be something along the lines of unprecedented prosperity led by American prosperity. So a lot of wonderful things happened post-World II, and the American middle class became the most dominant economic force in history. I would say things kind of came off the rails as to our previous point in the 70s when we decided to totally optimize for shareholders and corporate interests, and we started seeing a decline in the middle class. In the last 50 years, what we've seen is China add 500 million people to its middle class, and we've shed millions. So the China kind of pulling almost 500 million people out of poverty is arguably one of the great feats of humanity. And you could also argue directly correlated to its geopolitical strength. And I would argue that if there's a reason why you would not bet on America's future, it's that we haven't made the same type of investments in our middle class. We stopped investing in our infrastructure. We stopped believing that a progressive tax structure is the best way to go. And we we kind of embrace what I call a rejectionist luxury positioning, that once I have a college degree, I want to make it harder for people to get into my alma mater because it makes my degree worthwhile. Once I have a house, I show up to the local review board and try and squash any new development because I want the price of my house to go up. And once I have a technology company, I'm going to weaponize government such that I can practice monopoly behavior to ensure no small company gets out of the crib. So I think it's a variety of factors, but I would argue kind of 45 to 95 were kind of the salad days for America. We were the superpower, and I still think we are, but we have some, we have some things that obviously are very concerning: income inequality, divisiveness internally. Our discourse has become very coarse.
Let's talk about how things or why things changed. One of the factors I think we talk about in the book is sort of the decline of union labor. And does that happen around the time of the Reagan administration?
Unions for the last 40 or 50 years have shed about half their membership. But it's a phenomenon that's global. And that is, of the 47 Western nations that have some kind of heft or critical mass of union membership or something resembling a reasonable facsimile of organized labor, in 46 of the 47 nations, you've seen a decline in union membership. In sum, I don't think unions as a construct are effective representing the middle class. I think most people agree with 70% of Americans have a favorable view of unions. They think their intentions are noble. I would argue they just haven't been very effective. The minimum wage, they continue to shed members. If union is a product, it's shed half its market share. And minimum wage just is totally stagnant. I would argue we need that unions make sense, and we should have one very powerful union called the U.S. government. I think there's this illusion of complexity. I think massively raising minimum wage would solve a lot of our, not all of them, but a lot of our problems. And then there'll be these cautionary tales of job destruction. The states that have raised minimum wage haven't seen any job destruction, and actually have seen growth in their economy because lower and middle income houses really benefit from an increase in minimum wage. And the wonderful thing about those households is when they get incremental income, they spend it. So there's more of a multiplier effect. But unions, in my opinion, are absolutely noble. They're trying to do the right thing, and they've been ineffective. And I think this sudden quote unquote surge in union membership isn't actually a surge in union membership. There'll be a lot of stories about Starbucks workers organizing, but just because they organize doesn't mean they get a contract. I think it's a head fake. I think there'll be a dead cap bounce and unions will resume their downward decline. And I think the government needs to take a more active role in restoring dignity to work.
Another area that you highlight in the book is how Americans idolize innovators. We're seduced by their capabilities and blinded to the risks they present. Can you share the data points that you use to illustrate this?
Well, if, say, you started an internet photo sharing company or an app, and you became the wealthiest tech woman in the world, there's a 1 in 3 chance you would be Times Person of the Year next year. About every third year, Time decides that the person of the year is the richest tech person, not the richest pharmaceutical person, not the richest auto person, not even the wealthiest businessman, but essentially the richest tech person. I think as society, and there's evidence of this, as a society becomes wealthier and more educated, its reliance on a super being and church attendance goes down. But our questions get bigger and bigger. And so into that void of a lack of a super being or a religion slips in technology, because it's the closest thing to kind of mysticism or magic we can imagine. My iPhone's amazing. I have no idea how it works. Mm-hmm. So I find it just intoxicating and enthralling. And then you have these individuals who become massively wealthy. And I would argue the Jesus Christ of our generation that is increasingly not turning to religion is Steve Jobs. And maybe kind of Elon Musk is taking that mantle. And it's great to have heroes. The problem is they live by a different set of standards than the rest of us. They can commit market manipulation on Twitter, they can call innocent people pedophiles, they can toy with a company like it's a Kong ball, as Elon is with Twitter right now, and we don't hold them to the same standards. Steve Jobs, who's an incredible person, or business person, I'd say, denied his own blood under oath to avoid child support payments when he was worth $250 million. And I find that the tech innovators and big tech in general live by a different set of standards than the rest of corporate America and the rest of the populace. We definitely have an idolatry of innovators. We're just fascinated by technology and its leaders.
While taking care to avoid saying words I'm not supposed to on the radio, one of my favorite chapter headings is entitled, "The MDMA Dealer of Capitalism is the Corporate Communications Exec." So moving from tech to sort of corporations in general, talk to us a little bit about what you mean by that and a little bit about corporate mission statements.
So we've had so many technology companies who are losing money, get big so fast and create so much shareholder value that everyone's looking for the next one. And really for the first time in the last few years, about 2/3 of companies that have gone public have not been profitable. And it used to be less than 1/3. And so when you're not profitable and you're going public on kind of a promise as opposed to performance, it becomes more about the narrative than the numbers. So traditionally, most stocks traded between a range of their EBITDA and their growth and the sector they were in. You know, automobile companies traded between, let's call it 7 and 9 times EBITDA. And then if the CEO was seen as a visionary and very, you know, likable, you might get closer to 9. And if the CEO wasn't very good at telling a story, closer to a 7. It's been totally flipped. Now it's about 10 to 30% numbers and 70 to 90% narrative. And that is Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. They're so charismatic. The investor letter of Jeff Bezos makes you want to buy stock. Listening to Elon Musk talk about we need to solve, be hopeful instead of just focusing on, you know, things that ail us and we need to be an interplanetary species. These are really just compelling stories. And so the ability to shape the narrative has become increasingly important to a company's ability to raise cheap capital and pull the future forward. This has given rise to the public relations executive or the strategic communications executive. And there are more people in public relations and strategic communications at Facebook than there are reporters or journalists at the Washington Post. The number of journalists over the last 30 years has been cut in half. The number of PR executives or corporations has gone up sixfold. So the ratio of quote unquote journalism or the ratio, I would say, of spin to journalism has gone in the wrong direction by 12x. So that leads to the emergence of someone like Adam Newman that's able to create this narrative around building a better world and community when they're just renting desks and creates such a strong narrative. And he is so compelling and charismatic that people decide to overlook the fact that he's losing $80 million a week with a business model that will never make any sense. So there's this kind of mecca or Lollapalooza of strategic communications. It's all about the narrative. And then you have online platforms where people with large followings say something negative about crypto and then see, you know, dozens, thousands of bots weigh in on you and tell you what an idiot you are because you're threatening the narrative. And so it's become a battle of narratives as opposed to a battle of numbers. And I think that's dangerous for investors because it's kind of like who's loudest wins as opposed to numbers, which are just more reliable.
I like, again, how simplistic this book makes many points because of the data shown. I can pick it up, I can kind of flip through and learn a couple of different facts and feel much smarter afterwards. One of the areas the book discusses is cronyism versus capitalism. What's the difference?
So if you look at the bailouts, typically throughout U.S. history, when there's a tragedy or a crisis, there's a redistribution of income away from capital to workers. So the factory gets bombed or there's a pandemic and a lot of business owners lose a lot of money. But at the same time, to rebuild, we need workers and their wages hold. There's a transfer back from the wealthy, from capital to labor. What was different about this crisis was we decided to flood so much money into the market, $7 trillion, that about only 15% of people who received a check said they were going to spend it. So the majority of that capital ended up in the market. And 90% of stocks by dollar value in real estate is controlled by the top 1%. So we decided that losing 1 million people was meaningfully profound or meaningfully tragic, but what would be profoundly tragic is if the NASDAQ went down. And so we artificially supported asset values to the benefit of wealthy people. So the dirty secret of the pandemic was that for most wealthy people, the top 1%, the pandemic meant more time with family, more time with Netflix, and they got much wealthier. And the PPP program, which was supposed to bail out this cartoon of a cupcake bakery owner, didn't bail him or her out. It bailed out Shake Shack. It bailed out companies, airlines that have gone bankrupt 62 times since 2000, and yet for some reason they decided they needed bailouts. Now, why did they need bailouts? Because for the 5 years previous to the pandemic, they had spent 95% of their free cash flow buying back stock, which inflates their stock price. And the CEOs of the three biggest airlines had paid themselves $150 million in the 5 years previous to the pandemic. And then a pandemic comes along, air travel shuts down, and they decide that we're all in this together, that we should be socialists and they should be bailed out by the government. And so when you have capitalism on the way up, where we have these stories about the individual and pulling yourself up by your own boots, if you will, and those people deserve the fruits of their labor, which is a solid argument. And then on the way down, you have socialism saying these companies are a public good and should be bailed out by the market. That is neither capitalism nor socialism. It's cronyism. And the result is a transfer of wealth from the incumbents. And that is right now, if you're over the age of 75, you're 72% wealthier than people in that age group 40 years ago. And if you're under the age of 40, you're 22% less wealthy. We have transferred wealth from young people to old people. America used to be the best place to get rich. It's now the best place to stay rich.
Yeah, and you know, I was reading along in the book, and all of a sudden I came to a chapter called House of Cards. And it was like we slightly changed the subject, but we didn't. You talk about weaknesses in our foundation and one close to home, men. What do you mean by that?
So 40 years ago, the ratio of men to women in college was 60-40. And we decided, I think correctly, to level up women. People of color under-indexed in college. And people said college is a key element of transferring income groups and upward mobility. So we decided to level up people of color with affirmative action. It is now flipped. It's 40-60 male to female in college. And actually, if you look at who graduates, it's 1-2. Because men drop out at a greater rate. So for every two women graduating from college in the next 5 years, there's only gonna be one man. The education system is just biased against men. Two kids in the principal's office for the exact same infraction, the boy is twice as likely to get suspended. A black boy, five times as likely to be suspended. 7 to 10 high school valedictorians are girls. A boy's frontal cortex, cerebellum, doesn't develop as fast, and the kind of executive function that college and jobs need does not develop. An 18-year-old girl and boy applying to college effectively, on most instances, is an 18-year-old competing against a 16-year-old. The result is a generation of economically and emotionally unviable men. And the result is a decline in marriage rates, a group of men who are not attaching to work, not attaching to school, not attaching to a relationship. A belief that talking to strangers and sometimes approaching strange women is been conflated with harassment. I think that masculinity has been incorrectly conflated with toxicity. And the result is a group of men who are in their, and I'm going to be reductive here, are in their basements vaping and not establishing relationships and aren't economically viable. And the thing that we on the left don't talk a lot about is that women with college degrees aren't interested in mating with men without college degrees. Women mate socioeconomically horizontally and up, men horizontally and down. And I think the key to any society, the elemental foundation is relationships. One in three men under the age of 30 in America have not had sex in the past year. And people hear the word sex and their brain fires different ways. Think of it as just an elemental step to the foundation of our society, and that's a relationship. So we are producing too many of the most dangerous person in the world. And that's a lonely, young, and broke man. The most unstable, violent societies in the world produce too many of them. And I think it's a huge issue. And we decided to level up women. We decided to level up people of color, although economically, I would argue they're still not leveled up. Should we be doing the same thing for young men? When young men, I think young men have fallen further, faster than any cohort in American history. And there's a lot of biological, economic, and societal factors, but there's just no getting around it. Young men are failing. And when someone attacks Salman Rushdie on stage, it's not about the fatwa. It's about a young man living in his mother's basement with no prospects. You know who mass shooters are before you know who they are. They're a young male who hasn't connected to anything. And so I think this is an existential crisis. And I think we have to do away with this notion that if you start advocating for young men and start talking about the problem, it doesn't mean that you're anti-woman. It's not a zero-sum game. And I think we need to seriously look at leveling up all young people through investments in education and vocational programs, because people under the age of 40 in the United States have seen their percentage of wealth, as indicated by their percentage of the GDP they control, go from 19% to 9%. And it's especially hurt young men who are evaluated from a relationship standpoint disproportionately on their economic viability. So I think you have a group of people who are four times more likely to be addicted, three times more likely to kill themselves, and 12 more times more likely to be incarcerated. Young girls in single family households, of which we have more than any in the world, actually do okay. There aren't much different outcomes between when they're in a single parent household and a dual parent household. Boys come off the rails. The moment there's no longer a male role model around, they become twice as likely to become incarcerated and much less likely to go to college. So the question I would just present is, if men are failing this poorly, should we be having a more transparent conversation around what's needed? And does it necessarily, you know, is it a zero-sum game? If you want to help young men, does that mean that you're anti-woman? I don't think that's true. And the cohort I get the most support from when I go on shows like this is simple. It's mothers. My daughter's at Penn, my other daughter's in Chicago working for a PR firm, and my son is in the basement.
As a mom of two boys, I hope we leave no one behind. One of the things that I found really interesting was a chart that talked about online dating apps and how they're inequitable and the inequality of attractiveness. I'd love to hear more about this, and how do you measure some of these things?
So anytime you have technology come into an industry, whether it's retail, whether it's social media, whether it's search, it's generally kind of a winner-take-most phenomena. When everyone has access to everything because of technology breaks down the barriers of geography, you have one search engine with 93%, one e-commerce provider with 50% market share, one social media company controls 3/4 of all social media. That's happening with dating. Because of the pandemic, it used to be sort of you meet a third of people online, or a third of people would meet online, a third through friends, a third through work. Now it's more than 50% meet online. And what's happened online is a very strange effect, and that is the Gini coefficient is a mathematical equation that measures variance. And what we found is if you have 50 men on Tinder and 50 women, 46 of the women show almost all of their attention to just four men, leaving 46 men vying for four women. The bottom line is the filter that women have in terms of mate selection is much finer than the filter that men have. Men will swipe right, I think it is, on about half of the profiles they see, women dramatically less. And so what you have is this effect I call Porsche polygamy. And that is the top 10% of most attractive males online get 90% of the interest. And most of it is around their ability to signal either current resources or to garner resources in the future. So if you're a guy who just graduated from MIT and is working at KKR and accidentally your Rolex ends up in your profile picture, and you're geotagging from Aspen or from Manhattan or Newport Beach, you get all of the likes. And then kind of 50 through 90 do okay. And then the bottom half of men in terms of attractiveness online get absolutely no interest whatsoever. And so this leads to an unfortunate dynamic where the top 10% getting all the attention doesn't encourage good behavior or long-term relationships. And the bottom half become angry. The bottom half become resentful of women. The bottom half become much more likely to not believe in climate change, much more prone to conspiracy theory, much more prone to this truly misogynistic content on TikTok by men claiming to be pro-male when all they're trying to do is sell you some ridiculous fraudulent $50 a month thing or refer to women as, you know, as somehow it's their fault that they're there's some really ugly stuff out there being disguised as pro-male content. So this inequality online, if you take the Gini coefficient of online dating, it's more unequal than income inequality in Venezuela.
And that's saying something.
and it's really unfortunate. And the way I would describe the dynamic is it's been amazing. Online dating has been amazing for the top 10% most attractive males. It's the same for 50 to 90. It's been a disaster for the bottom half of traditional, like what I'll call very two-dimensional attractiveness for men. And it's been slightly worse for every woman online. So online dating is creating the same kind of winner-take-all atmosphere. And I think it's having a terrible impact on our society. We have too many men who aren't attaching to relationships and are becoming resentful of society and of women.
We are just about out of time, and I don't want our listeners to think that Scott Galloway doesn't have some positive prescriptions for how to get to where we need to get to from here. And that's in his last chapter. But, you know, I urge you to get the book to sort of learn about those kinds of things. Any book that has a back cover filled with complimentary comments about Scott Galloway, followed with, quote, insufferable numbskull, end quote, from Elon Musk, is a book worth reading. We've been having a wonderful time with Scott Galloway. Mountain Money, thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.